This is the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio, part of the VSporto Network, bringing you all Noles all the time.
In Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing.
Guys getting real banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success, so you know something, I can really do this.
We just beat the WGA.
Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast, everybody. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Just as a reminder, you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. You can also subscribe to this podcast through iTunes. That's the Unconquered Podcast on iTunes or your podcast manager of choice. You can always use that iTunes feed for your podcast manager of choice. You don't have to go through iTunes, just a reminder for those of you out there. You can also listen to this podcast on Seminole Sports Radio from VSporto, the best way to listen to this show. And listen on your mobile devices via the Seminole Sports Radio app, available on iTunes or the Android Marketplace. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please rate this podcast on iTunes and tell a friend. The more listeners we have, the more episodes we can get out, and the better partners we'll be able to find as we continue to grow our listenership. In any case, today we're going to have our last podcast before the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl, Florida State facing Houston. As a reminder, our last podcast we covered what to expect in that Florida State-Houston game, talking about how, as far as I can tell from watching tape and talking to some folks in and around the Florida State program, this really is a bad matchup for Houston. It's a very good Houston team. I think, again, as we've talked about, this Houston team is a lot better than people really think they are. They deserve to be in this game. They may be a group of five team, but they've got two quality wins over Power Five teams, and they beat the Navy team that just beat the heck out of Pittsburgh this last week. This is a very good Houston team, and it's a very well coached team. A team that, as Jimbo Fisher likes to say so often, is very multiple, both on offense and defense, and in a lot of ways they're philosophically similar to what Florida State does, even though with sort of an Urban Meyer-type approach on offense that's a little bit different in terms of more focus on the 11-man or quarterback running game. But overall, this is a team that brings a lot to the table. That said, like I said before, and like I said on the previous podcast, Florida State is a bad matchup for this Houston team for a lot of reasons, but mostly because of what Florida State's able to do in the secondary and the flexibility that they're able to use up front to limit the quarterback running game and the success that they've had against dual threat quarterbacks so far this year, more or less attests to that. A team with guys like Derwin James and Terrence Smith healthy at this point, That's not the kind of team that Houston, if they could choose, would choose to play in this kind of game. But either way, this could be a very competitive game. I do think Florida State, as long as they don't turn the football over, should win this game by a couple scores. But there's some other interesting storylines in this game that we're going to cover today. First of which is which Florida State players can bolster their stock the most, as far as their draft stock. The most in the Peach Bowl. Florida State's going to have a few players go into the draft. I think a few more players will be drafted coming out of this year than was expected going into the year. And it's going to be interesting to see where those players are drafted and how high they go and what kind of assessment they get. So we're going to cover that in the first segment. And then we're going to do a few final thoughts and predictions on this game in a second segment. And then I'm going to take the third segment and just cover some of the other New Year's Six games and talk about what we've seen so far and how that may influence what we can expect for those New Year's Six games and what we might see from, say, the national semifinals and the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl. Just talk a little bit about that and just a little bit of a national view going into the bowl games based on what we've seen so far. So let's get right into it. And actually, before we get into the NFL draft sort of discussion of which players can boost their draft stock, or where draft stock is more generally in this first segment, I think it's worth addressing, you know, talking about some of the things that we've been able to see in bowl preparation and some of the stuff that's happened here in Atlanta as we've been able to watch the open parts of practice in the Georgia Dome and things like that. Worth noting some of the stuff that I was able to see with regard to some of that. First of all, I have to say that this is the best that I've seen Sean McGuire look throwing the football since he's been at Florida State. I have to give the kid a lot of credit. He's really come a long way. When I saw him throw the football when he came in as a freshman, the spring of 2013 even, I really did not like the way he threw the football. I did not like the hitch that I saw in the release. He had a loop in there, just brought the ball down and would drop that elbow some and push the ball at times and tended to put the ball a little bit high, which is a death knell over the middle. But the kid has really worked hard and has really altered his throwing stroke. I mean, he's throwing the ball more authoritatively. He's getting the ball out more quickly, just in terms of just the mechanics of things. And that's, you got to tip your hat to Sean and also to Randy Sanders and Jimbo Fisher in terms of the work that they've done to get him to this point. Now, is he a great thrower? Are his mechanics exactly, you know, prototypical to what I'd like to see? And, you know, if I'm looking at an NFL prospect, no. But he does have a strong arm. Nobody's ever questioned that with Sean McGuire. But he did look the best that I've seen him look when I, you know, standing on the Georgia Dome sideline, watching them go through the open portion of practice. And, you know, looking more comfortable. I mean, that's something that, you know, I talked to Jimbo Fisher this last summer about the quarterback situation when they're bringing in Everett Golson, and talked about where McGuire was and all that. And, you know, I expressed my skepticism that McGuire was going to be where they needed to be because of McGuire's tendency to get the ball out late and just the overall lack of feel and lack of intuition and anticipation, getting the ball out and just tending to throw after receivers have made their breaks and things like that. And yes, some of that has to do with when live bullets are flying and all that, but to some degree you can see that even against air. You know, some guys have a knack to throw when guys are making their break and they know where those guys are going to be, and they just have an intuition for where to put the football in terms of accuracy, and some guys don't have that as much. To some degree, I think it's innate, but I do think it can be trained. I do think you can work on it and get better at it, and I think Sean McGuire has gotten a lot better at it. And Jimbo Fisher had sort of challenged me this summer when I said, you know, I just don't see it with Sean on that. And he said, well, you know, you got to remember, a lot of that comes with confidence. When you're still thinking and when you're still, you know, pressing, there's going to be that hesitation. But when you get confident, a lot of that just sort of falls away. You got to remember it's about confidence. And he just repeated that to me a couple of times. And I didn't really, you know, that's one place where I'm a wait and see guy. But I have to say, what I've seen from Sean McGuire, and you could see it going back to the Syracuse game during the season, McGuire has gotten more comfortable and he's gotten better in terms of getting the ball out on time and getting and throwing with anticipation now that he is getting more confident and more and he's feeling more secure in his position as the quarterback of this offense. And you could see that in his in the statements that he made in terms of the press conference earlier this week when he said, you know, he was asked about the quarterback competition in the spring, and he said, well, they can come out and compete all they want, but I think the team knows basically who the leader of this team is. And, you know, that's a pretty brash statement to make, but that is the kind of mentality you've got to have if you're going to be the quarterback at a place like Florida State. And, you know, I think that's the kind of sentiment that you want to hear a guy make, the kind of statement that you want to hear a guy make, the kind of sentiment you want to hear a guy express. And he's throwing more like that. It's not just bravado at this point. You can see that a little bit more in terms of the way that he's getting delivering the football with a little bit more authority. So that's a good sign moving forward, because you know, at this point, I do think there's still a lot of question marks in terms of what Florida State's going to have at that quarterback position going into 2016. You know, obviously you've got the young guys with DeAndre Francois, who, you know, watching him live, the kid was born to spin it. The kid was born to throw a football. And he's a guy who does have that very natural intuition and very precise accuracy. He knows how to spin the pill, and it comes easily for him. You can see that out there. But, you know, playing quarterback is about more than just throwing the football. And that's something that Randy Sanders, in his interview earlier this week here in Atlanta, you know, and again, Randy Sanders doesn't get to talk to the media all that much, but, you know, he was asked about the quarterback position, and he talked about how playing quarterback is about more than just throwing the football. You've got to be a leader. You've got to be a guy that is trustworthy, that the team trusts. And you know, he specifically brought up, you know, you can't be going out missing curfew and you know, having some discipline issues. And that was not by accident that he brought that up, because DeAndre Francois, from reports that we've gotten, missed curfew the first night that they came into town here. He was one of, about a dozen players that missed curfew on that first night in Atlanta. And you can't afford to do that. If you're a kid, if you're DeAndre Francois, yeah, it's Atlanta, and yeah, you're out, and you're a freshman in college, and you want to enjoy things. And yeah, I get that, you know, hey, when I was 18, you know, you hear this all the time. Well, when I was 18, I'd probably have missed curfew too. But the thing is, when most of you are out there at 18, you weren't competing to be the starting quarterback at Florida State. And a kid like DeAndre Francois needs to understand that, listen, he's got a choice. He can decide to go out and have fun with his buddies and go out and enjoy being out in the town and miss curfew the first night or two. But he can make that decision. He can do that. But it's a choice between that and having a real shot at being the starting quarterback at Florida State. Which would you rather do? If you were 18, which choice would you rather make? Would you rather go out and have some fun once in a while and miss curfew? Or would you rather be the starting quarterback at Florida State? Now, when I was 18, I would have taken the second one every time. I would have chosen to be the player rather than the guy going out having fun. And that's really something that Randy Sanders, I think, was bringing up. And that's something where Sean McGuire at this point is a guy they can count on. And that's going to be important going into next year. Now, obviously, this spring it is going to be a quarterback competition, and I've said in the past that basically Jimbo Fisher, as a rule, will default to the younger player unless there's significant gap between the older player and the younger player, because the younger player has more room to improve. It's only logical that that's the way that works. But at the end of the day, at this point, I do think that in all the other things, yes, Francois looks the best throwing the football against air right now. But in all the other areas, Sean McGuire's far enough ahead that Francois is going to have to mature a great deal in order to compete for that job. And the third guy is JJ Cosentino. And from what I saw, and you know, there's no way to sugarcoat this, from what I saw again in this, it matches up with what I this week, it's matched up with what I've heard before, and that's that he's just not going to be really a factor in that competition. Bottom line is, you can't miss throws. You can't put throws in the dirt or on the wrong shoulder, or, you know, 3 feet inside or outside, or, you know, 3 yards inside or outside against air and expect to be the guy when live bullets start flying coming out of the spring and into the fall for a starting role. And the thing is, he looks the part. He's got a strong arm, but it looked to me like he was pushing the ball a little bit, elbow dropping, and accuracy was all over the place. And you can't afford to have that sort of problem, those accuracy issues against air, and expect to be a starter. Now, again, he could potentially improve moving forward, but I don't expect him to be a factor in the competition going into 2016. The other thing to bring up there is that I felt that the difference between the older wide receivers, Kermit Whitfield, Bobo Wilson, Travis Rudolph, and the younger group was even more obvious to me at field level watching through that open portion of practice than it's been on tape so far this year. And I've said all year these guys aren't ready, and there's good reason that they're not ready. But it's obvious when you're down there on the field. It is obvious. I mean, of the younger group, only Nyquan Murray is really able to run the full route tree at this point the way that you want. And he would be, I think he would be able to be out there as a freshman, but he doesn't bring a whole lot extra to the table at 6 foot compared to the other smallish wide receivers that Florida State already has out on the field. So there's not a whole lot of reason to stick him out there when they've got other guys that are dependable at those spots. But the thing is, Florida State has brought in athletes at wide receiver the last few years rather than bringing in polished guys. You know, there are some guys who are more natural at that position. There, you know, you look at Calvin Ridley at Alabama. In addition to being an extra, year and a half or 2 years older than most college freshmen, I think he's 20. In addition to that, he's a guy that was a natural wide receiver. He came in pretty polished out of high school, and even it took him about half the year to really kick it in gear. And then, you know, he was very good. But you know, when you look at who Florida State brought in, George Campbell was much, much, much more raw than a guy like Calvin Ridley coming out, and he's still pretty raw. Auden Tate was more raw than George Campbell. And then you have the big receiver issue. Big receivers take longer to sort of get the precision and be able to sync their hips and make the breaks on certain things than what you get with smaller receivers anyway. But I could see that some of the younger receivers, by and large, were still having some issues getting their head around quickly on, you know, outbreaking routes and things, and that's something you've just got to learn to do or you're going to drop a lot of balls. George Campbell, it's pretty clear his right knee was affecting him. He sat out of a number of reps that would have forced him to plant off that right knee, and on one rep where there was a throw that was made to the wrong shoulder on an outbreaking route, and he had to plant on that knee. He dropped the football, and I think because the knee affected him. I mean, I had a couple drops myself when I was fighting through that, because it's the sort of thing you plant it and the pain shoots through, and then you don't have the full focus on the football. So I think there's pretty clear limitations in terms of that. Pig Harrison was missing the depth on a couple of his routes. You can't be at the wrong depth. Ball was hitting the ground because quarterbacks were thrown to the right spot, and he was not in the right spot. So, you know, I made a comment to a couple people out nearby. Well, that's why those guys aren't playing. You know, I could see, you know, there were different reps, and I'd be like, well, that's why he's not playing. Well, that's why he's not playing. That said, I can see that I think Auden Tate will probably get some time in this game. I think he's ready on some routes at this point. Don't be surprised to see him, particularly in some goal line packages. I think Auden Tate will be on the field. I think he's the most ready of the rest of the guys other than Nyquan Murray. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where these guys are coming into the spring. But it's going to take some time overall for some of the rawness to get knocked off of these guys in any case. Let's go ahead and get to the discussion of where several Florida State players fall in terms of draft stock and who can improve their draft stock the most in this game. I mean, obviously, Jalen Ramsey and Roberto Aguayo have a big enough body of work that I don't think either one of them is going to really impact their draft stock in this game. I mean, Jalen Ramsey is going to be a top 5 or 6 pick regardless of what happens really in this game. Enough tape is out there that as long as he doesn't get injured in this game, that's where he's going to go. He is the best defensive back prospect in this draft. And quite frankly, in my opinion, he may be the best defensive back prospect to come out in 10 or 15 years. He's a guy that can play basically every position in an NFL secondary. And based on what I've seen on tape, this is a guy who he's got some technique stuff to clean up, but they're minor technique issues, and he's shown improvement over the course of the year that you could see that he's worked on certain technique things. You can see the work ethics there, but there are minor technique issues that if he cleans up, I think he's in the top handful of corners his first year as a pro. And I think he may well be the best cornerback in the NFL his second year. You're looking at that kind of cornerback talent with Jalen Ramsey. And at the same point, if he went to a team that already had two elite corners and, you know, needed more at the safety position, he's a guy that could be one of the top three or four safeties in the league. So he's going to go early regardless. You know, this is a guy that again, and by the way, in terms of corners, if you want to think about a comparison for Jalen Ramsey, it's actually another guy who went to Florida State as the main athletic comparison. And then, but with a little bit better, with more sort of natural instincts for the game. I mean, he's very similar athletically to Antonio Cromartie, who was at Florida State when I was. You know, he's a guy that's going to be able to do a whole lot just because he's so long and so athletic and he's so fluid at that size. Very similar kind of athlete as Antonio Cromartie. Cromartie might have been just a little more fluid in the hips, but Ramsey's maybe a little more physical than Cromartie was. And both guys, you know, are going to be among the faster players, you know, both guys among the faster players in the NFL on their arrival. But that's basically what you're getting, only with more football IQ than what you're getting from Cromartie. So I think this guy is going to be just any team that gets him is going to get a treat. And then, of course, Roberto Aguayo, the most accurate college kicker in history, you know, he's going to have a chance to play a lot of years in the NFL. Kicking is a obviously a quirky position. It's one of those things that you can go from being on the very top to sometimes suddenly you get the yips or whatever, but Aguayo is going to go where he goes. You know, probably in the first two or three rounds he'll be off the board because he's such a weapon as a kicker. But those guys, they're not really their draft stock's not really going to be impacted in this game because they're known quantities, known entities. The NFL already is going to have plenty of tape to evaluate those guys on against better competition than what they're going to be playing in this game. And of course, Aguayo, his competition isn't going to really matter. It's just a matter of looking at the tape and seeing, you know, what he brings to the table as a kicker and looking at leg strength and all that. But there are a few players that can really help themselves for this next draft. I think the most notable pair is Terrence Smith and Nile Lawrence-Stample. Terrence Smith is a guy that I thought early in the year was playing at certainly an all-ACC level, if not an all-American level. I mean, he was probably in that kind of all-American discussion in terms of the level of play. He probably wasn't going to make all-American, but he was in that kind of level of play early in the year when he was healthy. And then he got hurt, and the defense really suffered when Terrence Smith went out. We've talked about that quite a bit on this show, that Trey Marshall and Terrence Smith's injuries really impacted this defense, and also the limitations, the injury to Nate Andrews also impacted this defense. But the injury to Terrence Smith was really, really a big deal for this defense because he was so good at that linebacker position, and he's one of those rare guys that he's good in all axes. He's good going, you know, right and left. He's good going forwards, and he's good going backwards. And those guys are rare even at the NFL level. And so the question is going to be how much impact he can have in this game, and whether he's going to be able to show the capacity to take on blocks. That, you know, they run a lot of power type stuff where, you know, offensive linemen are coming in, and the linebackers are going to have to take on blocks there. He's going to have to show for the NFL scouts that he's able to come downhill, take on blocks, and make tackles in the backfield in addition to doing what he does in coverage. And I think, again, this is a guy that he's probably going to go later than he should in the NFL, mostly because he's played the bulk of the last 2 years hurt. But I think he's a guy that – I think Terrence Smith is a guy that, sort of like Telvin Smith, when he gets to the NFL, could be a lot better than his draft position. And this is a game, though, where he can potentially, it's his one last opportunity to be as healthy as he's going to be, healthier than he has been in a while, to put some good film up against a quality rushing team. And so that gives him a chance to maybe show a little bit more coming downhill, making some plays in the backfield, that sort of thing. If he can be disruptive in this game, he can help himself. Now, I think the questions are going to be what kind of bulk he's able to carry at the next level. Some of these other things that are going to be determined in the offseason, in the run-up to the NFL draft. But I think Terrence Smith could work his way into the, you know, first three-round area, maybe third round, or probably somewhere between the third and fifth round. But, you know, I think with good postseason performances, with good testing and all that, you know, you could look at some team could fall in love with him for a given scheme and take him as high as the third round. And I think he could well outperform third round draft stock. So, you know, he's a guy that I think has a higher ceiling than where he's probably going to be drafted. And, you know, some team is going to wind up getting a better player than his position, his draft position probably will suggest. But he's got an opportunity to really help himself here. Another guy is Nia Lawrence-Stample, and he's a guy that was a fringe NFL draft guy coming into this year, but he's dominated on the defensive interior all year alongside Derek Nnadi. Those guys have been disruptive. Florida State's been very good against the run without having to commit a lot of players to the run, in part because those defensive tackles have been so dominant. And you go back all the way to the Boston College game and all this. Nia Lawrence-Stample has been dominant this year at that defensive tackle position. He's not been Timmy Jernigan, but he's been really, really good. And, you know, for him, he's going to have an opportunity. This is one more opportunity, again, to get good film against a team that's going to put a lot of pressure on those defensive tackles in that interior running game. And he's going to have an opportunity to show that he can both one gap and two gap. He's done both. And hold up against good competition. Now, Lawrence-Stample, I don't know where he's actually going to go. The question for him, the problem for him that he's going to have going into the NFL is size-wise, where does he fit? Because he's maybe what 6 foot, 6'1". He's undersized in terms of the size that NFL teams want at that defensive tackle spot. He's going to get sort of pegged as a nose, but he's going to have to be a nose in a one-gapping scheme for the most part at the NFL level because he's never going to be a Vince Wilfork, a two-gapper at that level at the NFL. But he's a 300-plus pounder. He has that kind of size. He's got really good mobility. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, testing and sort of some of how he measures up. You know, where does his arm measurement go? You know, how much length does he actually have to see where he winds up? But NFL guys will wind up breaking this tape down on him in addition to some others. And I think he's going to be a guy that's going to make an NFL roster. Again, probably a mid-round pick, you know, maybe fourth, fifth-round kind of guy at this point with good postseason testing and some other things. But he's a guy that probably gets himself drafted in that mid-round area and makes a roster. He's going to be a guy that probably contributes in the NFL, if not as a starter, as a bit of a fire plug that can come in on the interior and bring some things to the table. I mean, he's able to collapse the pocket and do some things that the NFL likes to see there. And he could find himself a role in some run stuffing positions as well. So again, he's a guy, it's going to be interesting to see sort of what the NFL does with him because he's not prototypical, but he's been good enough to suggest that he can fit in a lot of different things in the NFL. And the third guy that really I look at as potentially being able to do something with his stock, provided, you know, he's able to play healthy and do what he needs to do in this game, is Georgio Newberry, who came into the year with no chance, really, of getting drafted. And at this point, he's got a chance of getting drafted. Depending on how he tests, depending on a number of things, this is a guy that could go in that 6th, 7th round area, because you're looking at a guy that's 6'6", 280 pounds, and moves well. And, you know, beginning of the year, it was not even a consideration that this guy could conceivably go in the NFL draft, but he's going to be on some draft boards. Now, it's still probably more likely that he winds up a priority free agent, but because he looks like a guy that could be a 3-4 end, looks like a guy that has the flexibility to slide inside and slide outside and do a number of things with that athleticism, with that length, at that size, he's going to be an intriguing prospect for some NFL teams. And you know, an NFL team may give him a look in that, like I said, in that 6th, 7th round area. Like I said, probably still an undrafted free agent, but a priority free agent at this point. And a guy that, again, very well could make an NFL team because of the athletic traits that he possesses. But this is another game where, you know, again, if he's able to flash some of the athleticism that he does, maybe get into the backfield a couple times, you're looking at a guy that could, again, make himself some money. And you know, the NFL really likes guys that can rush the passer on the inside. And this is a guy that's 6'6", 280, who could easily be 290, 295. And, you know, one place that I could see him catching on in the NFL is the rabbit package up front that Florida State's been using with two defensive ends with Walker and Newberry at that those defensive tackle positions rushing the passer. The success that he's had rushing the passer on the inside in those packages, NFL teams are going to look at that and go, you know, we might be able to bring this guy in and put him at that defensive tackle position as a pass rusher in certain packages. And that, again, is the sort of specialist role. If he's able to do, you know, be a backup 3-4 end, but be the inside pass rusher and provide a legit pass rushing threat, you're looking at a guy that could play some years in the NFL because of that. So that's another guy that, again, we'll talk more about some draft stuff once I get a chance to break a little bit more down, of course, during the offseason and during the draft prep stuff. But these are guys that are going to have a chance to potentially upgrade their stock coming in. Now, you notice that I didn't mention Reggie Northrop. I don't think Reggie Northrop has much of a chance of getting drafted, particularly coming off that knee injury. He's clearly still not right in terms of physically on that, and he was not prototypical for an NFL linebacker anyway because of size. But he's a guy that could potentially play in Canada. He's a guy that could, that, you know, he's going to get a look as an undrafted free agent at some point. I just think physically he's going to have a little bit more trouble because of his limitations actually making it in the NFL. And then, of course, you have DeMarcus Walker and Marquez White, each of whom could go to the NFL after this game, each of whom could declare. I think it would be a mistake in each case. White is probably a first rounder if he comes out next year, and Walker is a guy that probably gets into the, you know, first three rounds, could potentially be a first rounder. I think more likely a second rounder with a good season next year. And this year, again, there's still some questions about what he's able to do and how much upside he really has at this point. But the one more year of further improvement under Brad Lawing, I think, potentially elevates him that much more in the draft. But both of those guys, again, those guys could potentially elevate their stock if they choose to go this year with a breakout performance in this game. I mean, if DeMarcus Walker comes out and has four sacks in this game, yeah, he elevates his stock and potentially puts himself in position to declare. But again, I still think it would probably be a mistake given the defensive line class that's coming out this year. But again, that's basically how things look coming into this game in terms of guys that could improve their NFL stock in the Peach Bowl. So now we move into the next segment where we're going to talk, just give a few final thoughts in terms of what to expect from this Peach Bowl game. What we've seen overall in terms of the bowl games to this point, and sort of look at the New Year's Six previews, what to expect from the New Year's games, New Year's Eve and New Year's games up to this point. I think the main thing at this point to expect from the Florida State Houston game is, again, I want to keep an eye on how well Florida State plays up front. The offensive line is healthier than they've been most of the season. They're playing against a Houston team that does a lot of different stuff up front, brings challenges in terms of their scheme more than in terms of personnel, but they've got good players. Are they able to handle all the stunting and all of the various blitzing and zone blitzing and the disguise that Houston front is going to present to them? That's one thing that I'm really interested in looking at in this game that is going to have some impact on what to expect for next year. I also want to see how, you know, the young wide receivers play in this game. I expect to see some Auden Tate in certain packages, and I expect to see some Nyquan Murray here and there. So what really can we see there? What does Pig Harrison look like? He's going to be the primary substitute in place of Ermine Lane in those four receiver packages. What is he able to do when he's on the field? Is he able to make a difference? Is he able to get the ball in his hand and be explosive and do the things that are the reason that he's at that position to begin with? And then, of course, in these bowl games, you start to see some of the young guys get more time. And I want to see which young guys show out a little bit and give some reason to think that they can do more next year. And again, you know, this is a team that's going to return every offensive player other than Everett Golson, who's not in this game. But every offensive player who's on the roster, every scholarship offensive player who's on the roster for the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl is going to be returning, absent, you know, transfers or whatever else. Everybody's back. So, you know, this is something where I'm looking at this game as much to think about next year as anything. And I can guarantee you the coaching staff is doing the same. They're going to be giving guys some opportunities to begin to audition for things, for roles next year. And I'm very curious to see how that works coming into this game. Now, looking at some of the other games around the country, you know, particularly games in the ACC, which are relevant to Florida State, it's been interesting because, you know, so far the ACC has acquitted itself well. It really should have won all three games on Boxing Day. Miami was the better team against Washington State and just played like Miami. They scored a go-ahead touchdown that was called back by a very ticky-tack block in the back on the goal line. Was it the right call? I mean, it was a defensible call. I'm not sure I would have called it as an official myself, but either way, you know, that was an example. They shot themselves in the foot every possible way and still only lost by six. And then Duke actually upset Indiana in the Pinstripe Bowl in overtime. That was a quality performance by Duke. I think the way that they were able to run the football on Indiana was the key there. And again, those were two pretty evenly matched teams, I think, from the middle of each conference. And then you had Virginia Tech, who oddly couldn't stop Tulsa at all in that game. But still, again, oddly for Virginia Tech, won with offense in Scott Loeffler's last game there. But Virginia Tech doing, you know, taking care of business there, didn't cover the spread by any means, but you know, ACC two and one start there. And then the Russell Athletic Bowl last night was a bit of a disaster for the UNC defense. Gave up a bowl record 645 yards rushing against an undermanned Baylor team. Now, you know, I thought Baylor would come in and run a lot of that, you know, direct snap stuff to particularly to Jefferson, their main running back now that Shaq Linwood is out. But I didn't expect them to run for almost 700 yards on North Carolina. North Carolina is not a, you know, they've struggled to stop the run all season, but nobody is really committed to running it that way on them all year. And Baylor, what they did is they spread them out and they demanded that they at least have a couple guys out of the box. And then they ran power at them all game. And I've broken down a lot of North Carolina all year, and they've struggled to stop the power play, the various, you know, power counter tray type plays all year. Baylor just did it with a numbers advantage, and they had guys that were just running free. I mean, the gaps were there, and they manhandled North Carolina up front. A lot of people, I think, are talking now about how this is a bad sign for the ACC going into the college football playoff with OU and Clemson playing. I'm not sure I see it as all that relevant to that game. You know, OU and basically didn't move the ball against Baylor any better than North Carolina did. Actually, North Carolina might have moved it a little better than Baylor or than OU did, to be honest. So, you know, in that regard, that's probably a good sign for Clemson that OU's offense didn't do a whole lot more against Baylor than North Carolina's did. And of course, we already knew North Carolina's defensive line was not very good. They've been scheming around it and you know, duct taping and doing everything they could to smoke and mirror their way around not having what they needed to have up front and in the linebacking core all season. And Baylor saw it, they prepared for it, and they gashed him repeatedly. And it was, you know, five seniors on the offensive line for Baylor against North Carolina's best defensive tackle was out, so it was three basically freshmen or redshirt freshmen on the defensive line for North Carolina for a good portion of the game, and it looked like it. So I don't know that really says much about what to expect from, you know, oh, wow, you know, obviously there's going to be a big line disadvantage with Clemson and OU. Well, there wasn't last year. Now, obviously, Clemson is not as good as they were last year defensively because of all those guys that they lost that went to the NFL. But they're still pretty darn good up front, and they manhandled North Carolina up front as well. They didn't do it as much on offense. Clemson's offensive line is not a dominant unit. But defensively, you know, Clemson's defensive line, I think, will be able to hold up for the most part. The question in that game, to me, looking at the first semifinal for tomorrow, the question in that game boils down to me on whether or not Clemson can hold up for four quarters. Last year they could because they had so much depth. This year they're just not as deep as they were, and you could see in each of the games that they played against quality teams, they struggled in that fourth quarter. Outside of Florida State, where they were able to limit Florida State's overall number of plays there, and were able to get a couple key stops in the fourth quarter. But for the most part, they struggled in the fourth quarter this year. Their fourth quarter numbers defensively were not nearly as good as they were in the first three. And I thought they wore down over the course of the season. I think they had nine or ten straight weeks without a bye, very similar to what Florida State had, 9 or 10 weeks without a bye to close the year. And they weren't very deep on defense, so those guys are playing a lot of snaps. And I think one of the keys actually is going to be how much that extra freshness, how much that extra rest is going to help Clemson's defense have their legs and be able to sustain through four quarters against an OU offense that's going to try to put a lot of plays on the board. So, you know, to me, that game boils down to whether Clemson is able to hold up for four quarters or whether they fade in the fourth quarter against an OU team that I think may be the best in the country. Now, you know, I think Clemson has the edge at quarterback. I would take Deshaun Watson over Baker Mayfield, and I think Clemson's going to be very difficult for that OU defense to stop. So, again, I think this is going to be a really interesting matchup. It's the more interesting matchup of the two semifinals, in my opinion, partly because I just don't think Michigan State is as good as the other three teams in there. That said, going to that semifinal, Michigan State, if you're going to match them up with one of the teams in the semifinals, they're more likely to be able to compete against Alabama than the other two because of what Alabama wants to do. Alabama wants to run Derrick Henry 30 plus times, and that's the one thing that Michigan State is well equipped to defend. They want to defend against a battering ram because they have, you know, ACC, SEC type defensive lines, top line, you know, Clemson, Florida State, Alabama, Florida, LSU type defensive lines and linebackers. They're able to go toe to toe. They want to get into a fist fight, into a brawl, and turn things into an alley brawl much more than they want to deal with the spread. I think they struggled with spread stuff all year, and I think that makes the X factor in that game Calvin Ridley. If Jacob Coker and Calvin Ridley are able to make a couple big plays in the passing game, I think that's probably enough because I don't think Michigan State scores more than, say, 17, 24 points or so in that game. I think they're going to struggle to get outside the teens in that game. So given that, I think a couple big plays from Calvin Ridley and Jake Coker in the passing game, and Alabama should win that game. And regardless of who wins those, we'll talk a little bit about the championship game in one of our future podcasts. We're starting to run a little bit long on time here today. But as far as the other two, that OU versus Oklahoma State game is really not all that interesting to me, to be honest. That Ole Miss versus Oklahoma State game, it shows you how interesting it is to me. I just am not very interested in that game. I mean, Ole Miss is missing Robert Kimdiche, their best interior defensive lineman, and they're going against an Oklahoma State team that, even though they're 10-2, I just don't know that they're that much better than they were last year when they were 6-6 or 6-5 coming out of the regular season, whatever it was. They barely made a bowl last year. I'm not sure how much better they are than they were last year. But again, I'm not sure which Ole Miss team is going to show up either. So to me, I mean, it's two teams that run the spread, two teams that are going to try to up-tempo and be aggressive on defense and create turnovers, and two teams that really just don't matter to me. So, you know, not much to preview there. And then you got the Rose Bowl, which I think is an interesting game because you got two teams, again, similar to the Michigan State-Alabama game, two teams that want to get into a phone booth and just have a brawl. And I'm interested to see whether Iowa's defensive line is able to hold up against, or their defense overall is able to hold up against Christian McCaffrey and a Stanford offense that really hit its stride late in the year. You know, that's a Stanford offense that put up a lot of points after the after that first game debacle against Northwestern. That's a Stanford team that I'll be interested to see how Iowa measures up there. Is Iowa able to hold up? I think that's going to say a lot about the Big Ten in this. I mean, I think a lot of times bowl games get overstated in terms of what they say about the conference. They say a lot more about the teams than the conferences. But I do think that's going to be an interesting one in terms of seeing how those teams match up front in particular. And then the other one that I think is a really interesting one is Ohio State and Notre Dame, in part because you could call this the NFL Draft Bowl. These two teams are loaded with guys. They're going to be in this next NFL draft. And between the questions of motivation and matchups, this is going to be an interesting one. I think both teams will be motivated. There's more rivalry, even though they don't play each other much, but there's more rivalry in the Midwest between Ohio State and Notre Dame than I think a lot of people who haven't lived in the Midwest appreciate. And it's going to be interesting to see whether Notre Dame's defensive line, which has some size and they run some odd front stuff, they tend to go with a lot of odd front stuff, whether they're able to cause problems for Ohio State the way that a lot of quality defensive lines did this year, particularly out of odd fronts. Are they able to create problems for Ezekiel Elliott and force Ohio State to beat them in the passing game? If they do that, I think Notre Dame could well win that game. Either way, a lot of stuff we've covered so far today, but that's going to do it for us. Before we get out of here, just a reminder that you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. You can follow us on Facebook, the Unconquered Podcast. Of course, Seminole Sports Radio on Twitter at Seminoles Radio for the latest on FSU sports. You can catch more preview stuff at Noel Digest. Make sure to catch our next podcast, which is going to cover the fallout from the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl. I'm Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio, a VSporto channel. Thanks for listening. I made this.